It was a horrible chapter in our city's history. And so for that reason, I can understand why Rahm Emanuel may not want to talk about it today. But for the reasons I'm about to give, and our speakers are about to give, is important history to remember and, yes, celebrate. Because as awful as the events of Chicago, August 1968 were, they were key to bursting forth and a series of events that led to the most sweeping progressive change that our country has ever seen, with the exception of a couple other eras. Today, when we are under assault by the idiocies coming out of the White House, I won't even say his name, you can read the banner. When we see these idiocies, these assaults on people who are black, brown, or women, who are gays, who are immigrants, and other countries around the world, we have to look to the history of how people confronted these kind of horrors in the past. In Chicago, 1968 was an important teaching moment for our movement. Because after people got their heads bloodied in the streets of Chicago and got rejected in the halls of the Democratic National Convention, even though 80% of voters had chosen candidates who were said they were anti-war, the Democratic Party went ahead and chose a pro-war candidate who had not won a single primary. And the lesson that people took from that slap in the face delivered in the convention halls and on the streets of our city was that they need to make the change necessary. They need to make the change to stop the war. And stop the war they did. They stopped America's longest ever war. And that happened because people depended on their own strengths, and not just here in this country. Obviously, the fight of the Vietnamese themselves rejecting U.S. domination, and soldiers within the military refusing to fight for a war of empire. Today, when we face America's longest war in Afghanistan and Iraq, those lessons are urgently needed as well. But it wasn't just the anti-war movement that learned. The Black Panther Party, which in August 1968 didn't even have a Chicago chapter, a year later had over 10,000 members, and they were making the change, starting with the free breakfast programs and other social programs. They forced the Nixon administration to quintuple the food stamp program, for example. Richard Nixon, arch racist that he was, enacted the most sweeping affirmative action program of any president before and since. The women's movement, and a precursor to the Me Too movement, got out into the streets and demanded their rights, with the result that a few years later, a Nixon-packed all-male Supreme Court enacted the right to abortion coast to coast. The gay movement, and I should have introduced myself, I'm Andy Thayer with the Gay Liberation Network, as well as the Chicago Committee Against War and Racism. The gay movement burst forth in June 1969, and it was in part informed by what happened here in Chicago in August 1968, because they rejected the hat-in-hand approach of trying to appeal to our betters, so to speak, the experts, the politicians, to free us. Instead, we demanded our rights and birthed a worldwide LGBT movement as a result. So I'm going to stop there. Just remember, as awful as the events of August 1968 were here in Chicago, what burst forth in the years following was one of the most sweeping periods of progressive change our country has ever seen. And that is to be celebrated in the days of Trump, when we urgently need all sorts of sweeping actions for freedom. Doesn't need any introduction to many of you, but let me give her a pitch anyway. Kathy has traveled the world in solidarity, whether to Afghanistan, Iraq. She has been on the ground with Voices for Creative Nonviolence, demanding the change and bearing witness to the horrors that the United States commits with its military. Let's give a warm welcome to Kathy Kelly.
Well, hello, good afternoon, and special thanks to all the people who've organized us to come together today and to recall that in 1968 in Chicago, responding to the song, "Won't You Please Come to Chicago," people had a very clear intent. They wanted to end the Vietnam War. Yes, the body bags were coming back, and people agonized over young people who were killed, who were drafted and killed in a horrible war. But there was also outrage over massacre, over scorched earth, over carpet bombing. And people were clear. You can still hear the echoes from years later as people shouted, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today?" Compare 1968 with the Democratic National Convention 2 years ago. When I grew up in 1968 and into the 70s, we couldn't imagine when that war finally ended that anyone would ever say, "Oh, let's do it again. Let's find a new Vietnam." No, of course not. But the military-industrial complex, with its growing strength and the power it gains from every single war it launches, was already hard at work planning the next war and the next, so that in 2016, we almost can't keep track of the numbers of wars that are being fought. In 2016, we find that the Democrats, even Bernie Sanders, aren't willing to speak up against the military-industrial complex, and so we have the sad and the tragic litany of war after war after war. War resistors, many of them in this plaza, could be almost likened to firefighters. You know, you stamp out one war and another one starts up, but those fires aren't started by lightning. The fires of those wars are started by greed. Greed for land grabs, greed for resources, greed to sell the weapons. And so we have wars that have gone on in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Lebanon, in Gaza, at the hands of the Israelis using our weapons. Wars in Somalia, in Africa, in Syria. You almost can't get the list straight to name them all. And then most recently, and may we pause over this one, war against Yemen. And on August 9th, they were children. They were on an outing in a school bus. They'd each been given shiny new book bags. They were excited, jostling each other on the bus the way children would. The bus stopped so their teachers could get food for a picnic. And a United States armed Saudi warplane, a United States fueled Saudi warplane targeted that school bus, fired a Lockheed Martin-made MK-82 missile, and 44 children were dead. And of the 76 that were wounded, there were so many children screaming and crying in pain, their bodies torn open, dazed, traumatized, burned, and maimed. They were just children. And so the United States war against Yemen continues. There was another bombing of 22 children who died just a few days ago. And we bear the responsibility to keep paying attention to the consequences of our war. And the military-industrial complex has a lot of money to pay very sharp think tanks and public relations groups to make sure that people don't know the consequences of wars. The military-industrial complex in this country doesn't want us to unite to say that we do not accept a permanent warfare state. They don't want us to recognize that these wars are actually going to prevent any rational discussion of solving our real problems. There can be no rational discussion about solving our problems as long as the military continues to take all of our resources. We could solve problems of police brutality, of mass incarceration, of environmental degradation. We could solve the problems of homelessness. We could eradicate disease. We could take care of the people who are hungry and needy all over the world. We could be beloved. We could make sure every student in this country graduates debt-free. We could do it all. But we can't do any of it and continue to feed the demonic suction cups of the war machine. And so let us come together and know that all around the world there are young people who do have strong movements, who are saying, stop the children, who do say, stop the wars, and who have every right to chant today, hey, hey, USA, are we going to die this way? Hey, hey, USA, will we, the children of the world, who aren't in the United States but bear the brunt of your wars, will we continue to die this way? Thank you.
Thank you, Kathy Kelly. Now, our next speaker served in the military, though she was unfortunately too young to benefit from one of the legacies of 1968, one of the great legacies of 1968 and the years following, and that's something that was called the Vietnam Syndrome. The inability of the United States to invade other countries at will. Because the legacy of the anti-war movement in 1968 and going forward was not only forcing the United States out of Vietnam, but also preventing the United States from invading other countries. Gerald Ford tried to invade Angola in alliance with a racist South African government a few years after Nixon was booted out, was unable to do it thanks to something called the Vietnam Syndrome. And over the years following, they did everything they could to knock out and discredit this thing called the Vietnam Syndrome that said that United States population would not stand for another invasion, another third world country fighting to free itself. Unfortunately, Natasha Erskine and her partners in the military were forced to serve thanks to that Vietnam Syndrome gradually being eroded. Natasha is with Veterans for Peace. She is a CPS mom, and so she sees directly with her own eyes the effects of the erosion of social services thanks to the insane spending on military. So I'd like to give a warm welcome to Natasha here.
Thanks, Andy. Good afternoon. Peace, y'all. How you doing? So I'm, like Zandy introduced, I'm a CPS mom, a devoted mom. I also take great interest in the over-militarization and the rise of JROTC that is replacing important programs and curricula like art. There's kids in Inglewood that are forced to take art and PE online because JROTC is a mechanism to remove the funding from schools, right? So we don't see PE teachers in certain school sets. We know that that's not right. We know that while CPS has an expansive JROTC program that has over 94% Black and Latinx students enrolled in JROTC, we know that that is not the key. We know that there's more to a classroom than militarized training. And so at Veterans for Peace, our chapter feels urgently that CPS needs to invite us in the room so that we cannot just tell students that military or glorify military, but to share an experience of veterans who served, to let folks know that there's another story. There's just not bells and whistles and opportunity and free trips that other students and opportunity that other students don't get if they're not in that military model. But there's also the violence of serving in the military where your moral injury comes down on you and you cannot understand and reconcile the things that you have done, right? So when we talk about, and we know the numbers of a high number of veterans that take their lives, we know that a lot of them do it because of the guilt of the things that they've done. So when we talk about militarization and we see these young folks in JROTC uniform, we know that that is a recruitment tool, and we know that at some point these young folks need to understand what's on the other side of JROTC, and it's a violent, reckless military industrial complex that sees no end from right now where I stand. And it's also around, thank you. And it's also around, I'll give you an example for a local school that does not understand that we need to evolve past the old mindsets that young people need discipline over mentorship, over innovation, and over progressive ideas of what it looks like for our young folks to be in a school. That should be a safe haven. We know that school policy is also aligned to a safe space for young folks on the south side of Chicago. So there's a local school where principals believe that, or ideology that believe that detention is the answer. So when we're talking about the over-policing of our young folks in schools, we know that we don't need police when we need more counselors. There are some south side schools that have one counselor and is somehow supposed to answer to the threat of violence, of homelessness, deep poverty, violence at the home front. So what we're saying is we don't need more police in our schools. We need people that can help solve these social and emotional harms that are put on our young folks just because they're poor. We need schools to be open from 6 in the morning to 6 at night and find programs that can invigorate these young people to create a safe haven for them. That does not include detention for reckless, you know, and I can say antiquated behaviors of what we used to think. Put them in detention and that'll get them right. No, these young folks are too bright for that. So there's a better way. And so when we talk about the over-militarization, when we talk about the over-policing of our young folks, let's be bold. Let's think about what can we bring into these school spaces instead of arms training, et cetera. We can bring in things and ideas around entrepreneurship. We can bring in invigorating ideas around coding, creating ideas, and ask our young folks, how do we cure violence? Have we thought about that? Let's bring them into the room. Let's demilitarize CPS. We need you all to stand with us. Let's be here for our young folks that need us the most. Thank you. And as I close, I just want to be very intentional when I talk about Veterans for Peace work around demilitarization of CPS. We know that there are some folks that are going to join the military like I did for economic reasons. We want them to know what they can expect. Recruiters will never tell you that. I know because 21 years ago when I went on active duty, I saw things that I should not have in my memory that do harm. So that's what we want the young folks to know. And when Veterans for Peace show up, we're talking about expanding the conversation around militarization, okay? Thank you all for being here today. I appreciate y'all. Peace.
Thank you, Natasha, Veterans for Peace. Listening to Natasha speak there a few moments ago, talking about the struggles of youth and the poverty draft, did you know that according to the Chicago Public School System, there are 18,000 registered CPS students who are homeless last year? 18,000. That stuff, those kids need our help. They don't need more bombs. Our next speaker has been a leader in the fight against police impunity for violence for literally decades. He is a legend in this town. He is currently fighting for an elected civilian police accountability council so we can begin to have some control over these police officers who do what they do with impunity. One of the most shocking things, at least for white people, of 1968 August was that the police were blatantly beating up people in front of cameras. You look at some of our signs there, you see one of these officers with his club over like this. That was a shock to all white people. Well, black people, I don't need to tell you. White people are learning it now because we got cell phones and we see the videos. Frank Chapman has been in the struggle against police violence and police impunity for decades. He's now fighting for Civilian Police Accountability Council, CPAC. So let's give a warm welcome to Frank Chapman. He's going to give you some more information about what you can do as well.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you, all you people who came out for this beautiful rally calling for the end of war, imperialist aggression. I want to thank you for keeping the flame burning. I want to thank you for keeping the trenches warm. Back in the 60s, well, from 1961 until 1976, I was a prisoner. I was wrongfully convicted. I was held in prison for that long. So I was in prison during the whole time of the Vietnam War. But they let you watch TV in prison. So I saw some of the biggest demonstrations during the 60s against war. They were some of the biggest demonstrations. Hundreds of thousands of people going to D.C. demanding that the United States get out of Vietnam, demanding that this imperialist war come to an end. And it was mostly white people. But Dr. King tried to turn that around because he came out also for peace. And he came out for peace based on some very simple principles and ideas, which we're still talking about today, and you guys are promoting here at this rally. He said that the reason why the war on poverty could not succeed in the United States is because of the war in Vietnam. He said the resources that could have been used to improve the lives of people in this country were being depleted by an unnecessary, aggressive, genocidal war. That's what Dr. King said. So where are we at today on this? We're not in the same place. We're in a worse place. And the reason why is because this country, first of all, let's get it straight about this country. This country, this land that we are standing on right now, was not stolen. It was conquered. It was conquered. It means it took a war to get this country. And that was a long war that started back in the 1400s, the late 1400s, the 15th, 16th century, and came on up until the latter part of the 19th century. And it was directed mainly against the indigenous people of this country. A long war of conquest. That's how this nation was born. It was born in conquest and slavery. That's how it was born. So it's no puzzle to me that's how they're trying to keep it. Conquerors continue war to continue to hold on what they took in the first place. So not only do they have the United States, but they also have the Philippines. They also have, let's just tell the truth. They also got Mexico. They also got South America, you know. So they're maintaining their empire through war, like all empires are maintained. So when we call for peace, let's understand who the enemy is. The enemy is those capitalist imperialist aggressors who are not going to stop at nothing until we stop them. We got to stop them. And I believe we will. But that's a whole nother discussion. I want to use the rest of my time to talk about the war in Chicago. The war in Chicago takes victims every day. Every day, in one form or another, either in the form of wrongful arrests, police torture, and brutalization and beatings, or out-and-out murder. The murder of Laquan McDonald. The murder of Laquan McDonald. The young man, the black youth that was shot 16 times. 14 times while he laid on the ground defenseless. This was the continuation of acts of war against our community. Because that's what the police act like in the black community. They act like an occupying army. They treat us like a hostile population where they can do whatever they want to do to us. They can kill us, they can beat us, they can racially profile us, they can do whatever they want to do to us. Because we're not in control of what they do. And so we're trying to change that. We're going to change that. Because we're going to get an ordinance enacted in this city, in spite of the odds that we're up against, that is going to create an all-elected, all-civilian police accountability council, CPAC. And what will that do? Okay, that will enable us, our communities, to hold the police accountable for the crimes that they commit, but more importantly, because you can't hold them accountable if you can't hold them accountable, it will give us the power to say who polices our communities and how our communities police. Without that power, we can't do nothing about these murders. We can't do nothing about the crimes that the police commit against us. So we got to give the people that power. When I say CPAC, you say fight back. CPAC!
Fight
back. CPAC! 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 All right now.
Thank you, Frank Chapman. The man is truly a legend in this town. I should also note that beginning Wednesday, September 5th, is the beginning of the trial for cop killer Jason Van Dyke, the man who shot Laquan McDonald 16 times. That trial is beginning again Wednesday, September 5th. And at 8 a.m. on that day at 2650 South California, we all need to be there in solidarity to demand that another cop who kills black people doesn't get away with it. Because left to their own devices, they will not give this man the trial he deserves. They will not do that. We need to be there 8 a.m. September 5th, 2650 South California. Now, we're going to have a little funds pitch right now. There are going to be people coming around with buckets. One of the other things they have is a list of to-do items you can do, and one of them is attending that rally organized by the Chicago Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression. So dig deep into your wallets. We don't get funded by the Ford Foundation, certainly not by City Hall. So we're going to have a little bit of music while we have a little funds collection here now. Please bring it up here, Jim. I should also note that we want you to sign up on the clipboards to be in touch about future events. And in a few minutes, we're going to have some really special speakers and close out the program here. But without further ado, I'd like to have our next speaker, Roberto Ferreira, who is with the Chicago Committee for Justice in Ayotzinapa. For those who don't know, Ayotzinapa is a small city in Mexico where 43 students were disappeared a little over 3 years ago. And they were just the tip of the iceberg of the violence that's happening in Mexico. And people might say, well, what does this have to do with Chicago 1968, United States 1968 or 2018? It has a hell of a lot to do with it. Because in 1980 Olympics in Mexico, the Mexican government, several hundred, perhaps thousands of people, right in the downtown of Mexico City, their most famous square. And as a result, people in Mexico saw the violence come home, much as we saw the violence come home here to Chicago. But more than that, what does it mean today? Those officers got away with it, as the officers in Chicago 68 got away with it. Now, Roberto's going to tell us about what's going on today and the impunity that the Mexican government thinks it can get away with in terms of the murder of its own people. Let's welcome Roberto Ferreira.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a good day, right? It's good to be here. It's good to remember that everything the system make against the people, someday will be punished. Someday we are going to have justice. 50 years is quiet in the life, in a human life. But in the history, it's just a little part of the history. And someday, the people will have a justice. 50 years ago, a student movement started in Mexico City. That movement was developing with other circumstances, and the government, the police, the system in Mexico, they were afraid. Because in other countries, the young people, they were moving against the war, against injustice. And in Mexico, the government, the system, was very afraid of that. For that reason, they started trying to kill this student movement. Finally, in October the 2nd, they really killed 300 people, 300 students, kids, moms, fathers, in the Tlatelolco Plaza. 2 days, they surrounded the plaza like this, and they started killing the people inside the plaza. That night, the plaza was red, full of blood. That happens in 1968. And nobody was punished for that. Still, the people that have families killed in that day, still they have no justice. And 50 years, and we are asking for justice in Mexico. The same that we are asking for justice in Ayotzinapa. 43 students were disappeared, and still we don't have justice. Still we are crying for that. In 12 years, more than 200,000 people have killed in Mexico. How we can say that? More than 200,000 people killed in Mexico. More than Syria or Afghanistan or other countries that they are really in war. And because this government is supporting the drug cartels in Mexico, here there are no capos in the United States. Nobody knows who is leading the drug cartels here. They say, no, they are in Mexico. But it's not true. In my neighborhood, every day they are shooting. I live in Garfield Park. Every day there are shootings. The young people, the African-American people, the young guys, they are dying every day. And nobody knows. The police is around, but the next week, again and again and again. And in Mexico, it's the same. Every day, people without heads, bodies crushed on the streets. And here, they don't know nothing. They are sending guns. They are sending money. And they are saying like nothing happens. It's the Mexican government. They are corrupt. They are. Everything have are guilty. Less here. Again, we're asking for justice. Ayotzinapa vive. La lucha sigue. Ayotzinapa vive. La lucha sigue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Roberto. For too many years, the left in this country has treated the issue of Palestine as an optional extra. Oh, so-and-so candidates, great on every issue. Well, you know, not Palestine. And they've gotten away with it. That's got to end. And here's a few reasons why. For one thing, Israel is by far the number one recipient of U.S. foreign aid in the world. Tiny Israel. Israel acts as the unsinkable aircraft carrier to facilitate U.S. domination of a whole host of countries. When there's a bloody dictatorship that's too dirty for the United States to support, I'm thinking Guatemala, I'm thinking apartheid South Africa, I'm thinking any number of other countries, Israel steps in and does the dirty work. It is a proxy for U.S. policy, and American so-called progressives who leave out the issue of Palestine, who don't think that the Palestinian people should have the full right to return to the land from which they were expelled, are not progressives in my book. It's about time we drew that line in the sand that you have to support Palestine if you are truly in favor of human rights. No ifs, ands, or... And the Democratic Party has been as bad as Republicans, if not often worse than the Republicans on this issue. The record aid package to Israel was passed under the Obama administration. Year after year, settlements stealing more and more Palestinian land. But you don't need to hear that from me. We have Samer Awada just returned from the West Bank visiting his family. He saw up close and personal what is happening to his community. Let's give a warm welcome to Samer Awada, who's a community activist. He is a sociologist, and I'm leaving out some stuff for Samer. Samer, thank you so much.
What's up, everyone? How are y'all feeling? Well, I have to apologize in advance. My wisdom teeth came in last night, so it's really hard to enunciate. And we don't have any goddamn health, universal health care in this country yet, so can't get that solved anytime soon. But I want to first and foremost thank the Chicago Committee and the Gay Liberation Network, Andy Thayer himself, and all the grassroots organizations that are present today and supporting a lot of our different movements that, it goes without saying, intersect. And I speak to you today on behalf of my mother's side of the family, who had to flee the ethnic cleansing in Haifa during 1947, 1948. It is for them that I say, free Palestine. I speak to you today on behalf of my family, who are not living, but are dying under an illegal occupation that this administration's deadly support for Israel's genocidal actions continues. From the lack of security, to the lack of potable water, to the lack of jobs, to the lack of reconstruction, to the lack of life, to the lack of pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness, they are much worse off now than they have been before. Never again should apply to my people too. We have an obligation to every last victim of this illegal ethnic cleansing, because all of this carnage has been done in the name of America and American liberty, U.S. freedom they call it, or so-called U.S. democracy. Since World War II, 90% of the casualties of war have been unarmed civilians. One-third of them are children. Victims of U.S.-Israeli fascism have done nothing to anyone, from Palestine to Afghanistan, to Iraq, to Somalia, to Puerto Rico, or to the Philippines, to wherever our next target may be. Their murders are not collateral damage. They are this is the nature of modern warfare. Palestinians don't hate Americans because of our so-called freedoms. They hate Americans because America, with the help of Uncle Sam and support of Israel, is committing human rights crimes every single day. The so-called war on terror is a cover for our military aggression to gain control of resources and people throughout Western Asia. This is sending the poor of this country to kill the poor of those countries. This is the killing and subjugation of oppressed nationalities. Young Palestinians do not go out of their homes to murder Israelis because they are Jews. They go out of their ways because they are our occupiers, our torturers, our exilers, the demolishers of our homes, the blockers of our horizon and future. Young Palestinians, vengeful and desperate, are willing to lose their lives and cause their families great pain because the enemy we face every day proves that their malice has no limit. And these times, remaining silent on our obligation to the world and its future for peace is criminal. And in light of our complicity in the supreme crimes against humanity all over and throughout the Middle East, and ongoing violations of the United Nations Charter and international law, how dare any American criticize the actions of legitimate resistance to illegal occupation? Our comrades across Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, Syria, our other colonies around the world, and even in our inner cities here at home are struggling against the oppressive hand of the U.S.-Israeli empire. As we demand respect for our humanity, we are labeled as insurgents or terrorists for resisting rape and pillage by the establishment. But the people of Chicago are my siblings in the struggle for peace and justice. The establishment of Israel was not the establishment of a democracy in the Middle East. It was the establishment of a basis for an economic occupation to continue after the military occupation was put in place. Palestine today, thanks to American intervention through the so-called Oslo Accords, peace deals, whatever the hell they want to call it, has been defined by house raids, death squads, settler violence, the prison industrial complex, checkpoints, detention centers, curfews, blood on the streets, and constant violence. We must dare to speak out in support of the Palestinian people who resist and endure the horrific existence the West has brought upon them through its bloodthirsty imperial crusade. Self-proclaimed progressives and leftists must dare to speak out in support of the American-Israeli war resistors, our real heroes, who, according to Dalia Wasfi, are the ones, quote, fighting foreign and domestic threats, including those terrorist cells in Washington, D.C., more commonly known as the legislative, executive, and judicial branches, end quote. Frederick Douglass once said, those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are people who want crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without the thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the roar of its waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both, but it must be a struggle nonetheless. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has, and it never will. End quote. Every one of us must continue demanding, keep fighting, keep thundering, keep plowing, keep speaking, keep struggling until justice is served, until the occupation is lifted, until apartheid is dismantled, Jerusalem is returned to my people will return to their homelands. No justice, no peace. Thank you.
Thank you, Samer. Another very wise man said, a nation which oppresses another nation cannot itself be free. Thank you so much, Samer. Our second last speaker before we march testified about U.S. war crimes in D.C. back in 2008. I'm sure it's a message that the Congress people didn't want to hear, but he said it nonetheless. Our next speaker is a community organizer from Northwest Indiana who served in the Marine Corps for 6 years, and he saw a lot of stuff that turned him into one of the most dynamic anti-war speakers and writers this country has produced. Let's welcome Vincent Emanuele.
50 years ago, my father was a Vietnam-era veteran and a union iron worker. He had his head cracked on the streets of Chicago protesting a U.S. empire that continues today, bombing Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Pakistan, Somalia, Yemen, and the list goes on and on. I live in Michigan City, Indiana, 60 miles to the east of here. As I took the train down today, and you drive by the corpses of global capitalism, empty cities, Gary, Indiana, sits empty, boarded up buildings, a heroin epidemic, gun violence, communities destroyed. Destroyed not only by a global capitalist system that destroys itself from within, but also because of the trillions of dollars that we have spent abroad at the expense of people here in the United States who need vital services. This country, in my humble opinion, is approaching spiritual death. You cannot spend what the rest of the world spends combined on your military year after year and be responsible for millions and millions of deaths across dozens of nations over the course of the past several decades and throughout our entire history. This nation was built on genocide, it was maintained by slavery, and it is continued to be maintained by a militarized police force, by increasingly detached capitalists, and as our previous speaker mentioned, the real terrorists, the terrorists who destroyed the southeast side of Chicago, the terrorists who destroyed Gary, Indiana, the terrorists who destroyed the towns and cities that litter the Rust Belt, they do not sit abroad. They sit in the boardrooms of the skyscrapers that we see lining this city's landscape. Those are our true enemies. And even before the Iraq War, unprecedented protests in March that included millions of people around the world, the largest coordinated protests in history. And yet, they did not stop the war machine. We have to ask ourselves, those of us who are sitting here today, what kind of actions, what kind of strategies, what kind of tactics will it take to dismantle the largest and most powerful military-industrial complex the world has ever known? It is going to take a level of commitment and dedication and personal sacrifice that is unprecedented in this country's history. I truly believe that, and I truly believe that the people who are going to lead that movement are standing amongst us here today. I see old faces and old friends. I see new faces, and I made a new friend riding on the train today, a gentleman who came here from Poland, escaping war, and finds himself in a nation that is dominated by war, both abroad and at home. And the same tactics and strategies that U.S. troops use abroad are back home and used on the civilian population. The best example of which is John Burge, the Chicago police sergeant who was torturing young black men in the city of Chicago using the same tactics and techniques that he learned in Vietnam when he was torturing Vietnamese civilians. We need to work as hard as the executives at Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and the lobbyists and politicians in the halls of Congress who continue to push the nonstop war machine. And as Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. said 50 years ago, every bomb that drops on Vietnam explodes in the streets of America. It is the same today in 2018. Every bomb that's dropped in Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, Yemen, Pakistan explodes in the streets of America. We are the richest nation in the history of this planet. We have enough wealth and resources to provide everyone in this country and others food, housing, healthcare, public education, and everything else, including clean drinking water, the kind of which that's missing in cities like East Chicago, where we organize. Let's remember who our enemies are. Let's maintain the discipline and sacrifice it takes to build a movement, because this country needs a new anti-war movement now than it has ever. And the people who are going to do that are standing here today. So what we're going to do when we go home is organize, organize, and organize. And the numbers we see here today will multiply, because we know that the Trump administration has its eyes on Iran. We see what they've done in Venezuela. We've seen the increase in drone strikes. We see what's going on in Palestine, in Syria, and beyond. It is up to us here today to continue the tradition of the 68th generation, to continue to push in even these dark moments. I have trust and faith that that can happen and will happen in my lifetime. We have to have that hope. We have to have that level of dedication. And I find the hope and inspiration in the voices and the people that I see here today. Thank you for coming out here. Let's remain committed and let's end the U.S. empire.
Thank you. Thank you, Vincent Emanuele. Our last speaker before we march has been a mentor to the Black Lives Matter movement. She was a legend before that movement even burst forth. Tremendously respected for her thought. She is part of the majority and nationally works with Movement for Black Lives. She's just published a new book, Making All Black Lives Matter, Reimagining Freedom in the 21st Century. Barbara Ransby is a treasure for Chicago. Let's welcome her the way she deserves.
So I'm really glad to be here today. When Andy Thayer called and asked me to come and speak, I immediately tried to say yes, and eventually I did say yes. But Andy not only talks about solidarity, but he walks the walk. Every time organizations that I've been involved with in the city needed speaker amplification, needed some tech support, Andy was there providing that kind of support to us, and always on the right side. So I'm happy to be here today. I'm also happy to be a part of this lineup of speakers. The brother who talked about Ayotzinapa, the young brother who has the Palestinians for Black Power. These are the kind of connections and alliances that we have to make in order to have a vibrant anti-war movement that's going to make a difference in this country, and we have to remember that. So we're here today to both remember and to resist. I'm a historian by training and an activist by choice, and that's what I do for a living, right? I remember the past and I resist in the present. So we're here to remember 1968, that pivotal year of both repression and violence, but also an important year of resistance from Chicago to Mexico City to the streets of Paris where the students and workers took over. All around the world, there was a spirit of resistance and revolution. I want to also say something about the year before 1968. I was 10 years old, and I was a kid growing up in a working-class neighborhood in Detroit. And we had had all too much police harassment and violence in our communities. We had an organization called STRESS that was a cop decoy unit that was setting up and murdering young Black people in that city. And so we were about the business of resisting police violence and the racism that it embodied. But we also saw something else happening. We saw our cousins, our neighbors, our friends coming back in body bags from Vietnam. And we immediately made the connection between militarism abroad and racism and police violence at home. And we continue to make those connections today. The brother that spoke before me talked about John Burge. John Burge's resume, the resume he brought to the Chicago Police Department in 1970, what was the most important line on it? He had been trained by the U.S. military. And this is not to blame people who are drafted through an economic draft into the military, who in there because they're not educational options and job options. But it's to know the toll that military takes on not only the civilians in places like Afghanistan and Yemen who are being bombed today, not only in places like occupied Palestine where U.S. money supports the Israeli occupation, but the victims of war right here in Chicago. The war against poor Black and Latinx communities, the war against our undocumented brothers and sisters. And so we have to make those connections. We have to understand those connections. We have to articulate them in the work that we do. I remember in thinking about Detroit in 1967, it was federal troops that came into Detroit to put down that rebellion, and that was no coincidence, right? So the links are right in front of us. So I'm honored to be on this panel with people like Natasha Erskine and others who understand that link between violence at home and imperialist violence abroad. I'm also proud to be in a community of activists who are fighting back against the Cop Academy being built, attempt to be built in this city. So we have to say no Cop Academy because we understand the connection between 50 schools being closed in the city of Chicago, the abandonment of Black and Latinx and working class kids in this city, and those funds going, $95 million, going to build an academy, a school, that's going to train police to do more of the violence that they've been doing in their community, in our communities. That is not something we can allow to happen.
That's right.
I also want to hold up the Deadly Exchange campaign that Jewish Voice for Peace and others are involved in, which show the links between police departments in this country and Israeli police department and its militarized police tactics there, training U.S. police departments to carry out that same kind of those same kind of tactics here. Again, in making these connections, I think we have to always have in mind the big picture. Now, I've made connections in these few remarks about the injustices that exist in Chicago, the injustices that exist around the world. But what we also have to do when we remember and resist is remember that people have, in fact, won. The biggest lesson of history is not that oppression has always existed, injustice has always existed, but is that we have always been fighting. That wonderful quote from Frederick Douglass, right? You know, there is no struggle without, there is no progress without struggle. Well, people have always struggled, and we have to struggle more in a more determined way. We have to struggle in a more united way. We have to learn lessons from history, and if we do, we can win. I have lived long enough to see anti-war movements contribute to the ending of certain wars. And even when we have other wars that start up, that is still a victory, right? It's not all the same. I participated in the anti-apartheid movement in the 1980s. It was very close to my heart. Many of my comrades in the ANC made enormous sacrifices in that struggle, but people in this country did too. And quite frankly, I didn't think apartheid would end in my lifetime, even though I gave many speeches saying that it should, and it did. And so that's a lesson of history as well, right? When we unite, when we struggle, we can win. And my final comment, because the disciplined brother here is telling me that the time is just about up, is I would be remiss without inserting feminist politics into this conversation. Women have been in the forefront of the struggle against wars all over the world. Women have been in the forefront of the movement for Black lives. Feminists have been in the forefront of the struggle against police violence in this city. All over the world, women, mothers, sisters, and sometimes combatants are involved in struggles to end wars of aggression and to end violence in our communities. We have to also be inclusive of the LGBTQ community. We can't throw anybody under the bus in building the kind of movement and the kind of struggle that will give us a serious, serious victory. So thank you all for being a part of this. We got to double and triple and quadruple these numbers. We got to have more young people here. We got to have more Black people here. We know that work has to be done. Let's figure out how to do it. They call it struggle for a reason. It's not easy, but there's joy in the work because there's victory if we persevere. Thank you. Aluta continua.
Thank you, Barbara Ransby. Well, we're going to march now. And this, we chose Richard J. Daley Plaza for a reason. You know that, okay? We also chose to circle around City Hall and go past the Cook County Democratic Party headquarters, okay? So, folks over here with a yellow banner here, please go over there. Line up behind them the yellow banner that says peace, jobs, equality, and let's march to the Logan Monument and let's remember what Chicago 68 birthed. It was a massive movement for change such as we need today.